A Brush With is sponsored by Bloomberg Connects, the arts and culture app. Created by Bloomberg Philanthropies, Bloomberg Connects lets you access museums, galleries and cultural spaces around the world on demand. Download the app to access digital guides and explore a variety of content. Hello, I'm Ben Luke and welcome to A Brush With, the podcast from the art newspaper in which I talk to artists about their influences, from writers to musicians, filmmakers and of course other artists, and the cultural experiences that have shaped their lives and work. And in this episode, it's A Brush With Michael Raedecker, who brings together paint, thread and painted imagery to create canvases pregnant with unsettling and uncanny atmosphere. At the heart of his work is the meeting between humanity and nature, and even though his paintings are mostly unpopulated, the presence of people is always implied through their absence. In landscapes, we see the interiors and exteriors of homes with lights on, beds ruffled, curtains half drawn, cars outside. We witness empty lounges beside a swimming pool or an unoccupied lilo floating on its surface. In still lives, we seem to be witnessing a hastened process of decay. Images become almost hallucinatory through the emphases Michael gives elements of his compositions, with heightened texture or colour or surreal disjunctions. We're thrust into riddles, stories, or dreams that are familiar yet otherworldly. Michael was born in 1963 in Amsterdam and has lived in London for more than 25 years. His first graduate study was in geology, which he quickly rejected for fashion design at the Gerrit Rietveld Academy in Amsterdam. He worked in fashion houses, including for the Belgian designer Martin Margiela, before beginning to study art at the Rijksacademie in Amsterdam and then at Goldsmiths College in London. Because he came to art from fashion, Michael's always seen himself as something of an outsider, which he's used to his advantage in both his choice of media and his subject matter. His earliest works were informed by a chance encounter with paintings made by Winston Churchill in the library. The art of what Michael called an unpretentious Sunday painter, who wrote an essay called Painting as Pastime, liberated him and prompted him to think of materials associated with other pastimes, like embroidery. At that point, in the early 1990s, as he said, it all started to fall into place. He took laser-printed reproductions of Churchill's paintings, mostly landscapes, and used a pigment transfer technique to apply them to the canvas, on which he would add thread. With his process honed, he set about creating the imagery that became his hallmark, using depictions of domestic interiors and architecture as the building blocks of spare but strange compositions, in which certain elements rendered in fibre would loom out from the canvas. From the mid-1990s, into the new millennium, Michael's compositions became more intense and more daring. A rich group of works focuses on modern buildings in landscapes, often emerging from gloom. Ins and Outs from 2000 features the fluorescent light of a garage radiating disquietingly from within a deep blue landscape. Numerous paintings from this period feature picture windows like idealistic images from interiors magazines, but aspects of the architecture or furnishings are highlighted to suggest all is not right. Rugs seem to become infested. Water appears to flood the space. Other canvases present unexpected views of environments. In Kismet from 1999, a lake in poured white paint surrounded by trees is seen as if from a bird's eye view. In Exposure from 2001-2, a constellation of stars rendered with flecks of fabric and framed by trees that are dark knots of thread is seen as if from the perspective of a person lying on their back. As Michael refined his technique, he began increasingly to explore the different genre of painting, making portraits, some based on old masters, as we'll hear, and still lifes, including flower paintings, in which the stench of death pervades the image. He continued to push his outsider status by choosing supposedly humdrum or lightweight subjects, like wedding cakes, chandeliers, and bedspreads, and imbuing them with psychological tension. He increasingly pushed his formats too, making multi-canvas works on a vast scale. They include painting of ancient ruins made at the heart of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan that are the closest he's come to overt political commentary. He also began to fragment his imagery across canvases. After many years in which he'd stopped using the laser-printed pigment transfers that he used in those early Churchill paintings, Michael's recently returned to the technique and reinvigorated it through digital manipulation, so that his recent works, many involving swimming pools, tree houses, lakes with jetties, and those same suburban buildings in spectral landscapes that he's portrayed across last three decades are some of the most bold and dramatic he's ever made. He creates these scenes so steeped in cinematic ambience and poetic aura through the unique collision of materials that require very distinct methods of application and control. And it's this with which I began our conversation. Is that meeting of the haunting presence of the found image, the liquid uncertainty of paint, and the steady weave of thread about creating a productive tension between deliberation and accident?
I like to think ahead. I sometimes compare it a little bit with a chess player, that you have your moves. So you have an idea that then becomes a sketch, and then at some point you make the step to the painting. So you can only think ahead a number of steps, I suppose. And it's nice to have a framework where things are determined, but still be able to, at some point, use your intuition or being in a flow, and therefore steps just follow one after the other, I suppose.
Yeah, but you get these kind of really interesting moments where the different elements of the composition collide. So you have a printed element and it hits against a painted element and that hits against the thread and so on. And it seems to me that lots of what makes the painting so interesting emerges from those kind of collisions, if you like, and the way that kind of more deliberate element might meet an element that it may not have originally meant to, or you might have not have foreseen when you were making the work.
Yeah, I guess that's essential in a way about painting. It's not a Warhol painting by numbers thing that you fill it all in, right? So it's always start with the idea, of course, that particularly now when I've been doing this for more than 30 years, you want to keep it interesting for yourself. So there is definitely a method. I think every artist has a method, but during the years you slowly adapt or go into different little avenues, and then maybe you come back to the things that you are more familiar with. And yeah, as you were saying, I also print on canvas, which is a technique that I sort of reintroduced a couple of years ago. So there are all these different steps, and I think my process has become much broader that way. There are a lot of ingredients in the mix, so to speak.
Tell us about your method, because you call them demos, right? So you make an initial kind of sketch, a kind of preparatory work to a certain degree, and then from there, take us through the process to the final painting.
Well, yeah, the digital chapter became a part as well within my work. And as I said earlier, I start with an idea that becomes a sketch, and then I go to the canvas. I kind of make my composition, paint it, then photograph it, put it into the computer, that image, and start to work on it and manipulating the composition, start then also working with colors. I usually paint that initial painting in a kind of a, I call it like a chroma key green or sometimes a blue. Mm-hmm. So in the computer, with Photoshop, I start to play with those colors. And so at some point you may feel, okay, this is getting somewhere. I'm now ready to print. But what may look good on the screen may not work so well when you start printing. Also, the way I print, the way I transfer the paintings, which I do in the studio, it's a very lo-fi technique, which I kind of like. I print basically two layers on top of each other. And so it's difficult to know how the colors are going to look like, the intensity, the saturation, etc. So that's why I have to make these tests. And it's also then handy to work with these tests later and play with threads. So they are sketches. They are elaborate sketches, and that's why I call them demos. They are not the real things yet, but yeah, an initial beginning.
Do they get destroyed, or are they works? Do they lurk somewhere here in the studio?
Well, no, the demos are sort of smaller versions of the real paintings. But of course, it's also a play in a way, what is a real painting? A painting is supposed to be unique. Here, there are two versions of them, a smaller one and a larger one. And it's up to the viewer, I suppose, to decide which one is the better one, perhaps. Although, I have to admit, I usually show the paintings and not so much the demos. But the initial painting that I do, as I was describing, that when I start with the idea and the canvas, that one gets thrown away.
Right.
The chroma key colored one that gets thrown into the bin.
Right.
Tell me what you're looking for when you're deciding on that color. So you've got that chroma key and then you bring it into the arena of the computer, the arena of the digital. What are you trying to do with the colors at that point?
I've always had a kind of a tricky relationship with color, particularly if I compare it to most painters, in the sense that I'm quite monochromatic in my use of colors. I don't feel the need to describe all the details in paint. Paint has usually been the quick and short chapter within, you know, getting to the end result. What is extremely handy on a computer these days in Photoshop is, of course, that you can just move your mouse around and you go from all the colors in the spectrum. And so you can try and see that way what may work.
So it's an intuitive process, basically. But for instance, in some recent paintings, there's these incredible vivid reds that you achieve that seem to me to be almost like an X-ray, a reverse, if you like, of the kind of colours that you're talking about in that chroma key, the deep blues and the greens.
Yeah, it was also the initial idea to go back to the technique that I started with and then had dropped for 20, 25 odd years. Yeah. Because with the paintings that I made for that 20, 25-year period, I felt it way more difficult to use color. And so that was the initial idea, to go back to that technique. Because, as I said, I print two layers on top of each other, and therefore you get this extra saturation. Mm. And what I couldn't really do with real paint, I find I can really play and do with in the computer.
And then tell me about your image sources, because I interviewed you many years ago. And at that time, for instance, you told me that you were using a book called Clotheslines USA, which was this kind of strange book of washing line photographs. Yes. I know that you've used 50s Homes and Gardens type magazines. You know, it's quite broad, your range of sources, isn't it?
Yeah, it can come from everywhere. I think images, I see them as tools. I hardly ever copy a whole image. It's more bits and pieces that get combined. Or I've been making paintings with cars over the last couple of years. And so I've got these two little model cars that I can just put on my table, and then I photograph them from different angles. It's just a tool to get the perspective right, to have an initial idea. And I guess the characteristic is the fact that I use all sorts of types of images, but then there is always the absence of us, of a human being.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's always about us, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you really play on that, don't you? It's an incredibly productive space, that kind of emptiness. You know, we feel a human presence, but we feel its absence. So therefore, it's this kind of really pregnant absence. You know, there's open doors, there's interior spaces which seem loaded. The lights are on. It's almost like the car's engines are still running, you know. There's a real feeling that it's only recently been uninhabited, this space.
Yeah, it's playing with familiarity. In a way, we seem to know all these type of images, whether it's from our own lives or from the movies we've seen, etc. I think for me, it's also to do with the idea probably that we did not really choose to be here. We didn't have anything to say in the matter. Nature, the landscape, has been here long before us, and it will be here long after we are gone. And I don't mean just you and me, but also us as a species.
Yeah.
And we have to deal with nature, but nature doesn't deal with us. It just does its own thing. You know, human superiority, intelligence, and arrogance found an impressive way to inhabit and conquer Earth, to create humanity and achieve a quality of life. But however, existentially, every generation is still trying to get used to being here, you know, not always knowing if we even belong here.
Right.
Not always able to express what we really want, what we really mean to say. I guess throughout the 30 years of my practice, I've made works that deal with this sort of alliance, symbiosis, or confrontation of us versus nature,
yeah,
right? Our place in this world. And I think I've made paintings that deal with this presence, but visual absence of us in relation to our environment and the world we live in, you know, the indoors and outdoors, the area where nature meets the suburban setting, the man-made dwellings, in a way. I've lived most of my life in a city, but cities are always absent within my work. I'm way more intrigued about this idea of, like I said, nature versus us.
Yeah. It feels like nature's a character in some way, and you do that very eloquently through the thread, I think. So quite often there are knotted elements where, you know, I'm thinking about tree canopies and trunks and so and so. And it becomes almost hallucinogenic, some of it. You know, it has a kind of presence which goes beyond its just a sort of mere factual kind of representation.
Yeah, when I had the idea of using threads and embroideries and that craft, quite quickly I felt I got all these sort of nods that I was doing the right thing, because, you know, in a way it's the most stupidest technique that you can imagine, right? You penetrate the canvas and then at some point you have to come out elsewhere, and it can be 1 millimeter, it can be a meter. But so whenever you do that, you can get a straight line, which is ideal if you want to work with architecture. There are so many types of yarn and wools around that are woolly, and therefore they resemble things within nature. So it felt like it was really the right material to use. I got the green light in a way.
Yeah, absolutely. But you also, like, for instance, that you've really productively used fake fur, and in a much more kind of anarchic way than, for instance, the straight lines that you might be able to achieve with thread. So the kind of way that you've used textiles isn't purely as a kind of linear element of the work.
No, the idea of using fake fur was more that I would cut into the fake fur and these sort of fibers would then land onto the canvas, and then I would paint it. And it's almost playing with the idea that this work has been around, has been there long before us, in a way, the topics.
And that, there's a sense of that aging, almost distressing of the canvas, so that you place it in a kind of timeless space. It can evoke the now, but it's not necessarily saying this is a scene from 2024. It's a scene which exists in all sorts of different spaces temporarily.
Yes. I mean, I guess I use as architecture a lot of sort of modernist architecture. But, you know, these houses have been around now for a long time. So it's not that I'm only referencing the 1960s or 70s. Mm. They are still part of our culture today, yeah.
And they're sort of generic as well. You don't want to point to a particular kind of architectural identity in terms of an architect like Le Corbusier or somebody like that, like other artists have. You want to make it sort of sufficiently generic that it can engender all sorts of meaning, in other words. So you trust the viewer to imbue it with a certain level of meaning that's up to them, if you want.
I think giving straight references can be a distraction to what maybe is really to be seen taking place in the paintings. So yes, definitely not a known architectural place.
But triggers for known images and scenes and perhaps paintings and so on. So in a way, it's a space we all know to a certain degree. You're calling to our memories, you're calling to our imaginaries. You know, there's a sense in which we're all sort of implicated in the work to a certain degree.
Yes, yes. Like I said, it's about familiarity. That is the first step to lure you in a way. And then you're left to your own devices, I guess. Yes, we've all seen and experienced so much, and therefore you don't need to point things out. You need to leave blanks and open spaces.
Earlier on you said about how threads in a way are the most, I think you said stupid. What was the term you used? The most stupid kind of idea?
Well, not as an idea, but as a technique.
Technique, yes.
It's not complicated, like, I don't know, like with knitting, you have all sorts of different ways of knitting. And I guess with embroidery as well, but I like the straightforwardness, of course. And when I started as an artist, I guess for me there was always the fact that painting was more than just paint on canvas, you know, that had been done for hundreds of years. Mm. Looking back, I was drawn to an aesthetic whereby I was investigating painting as a historical medium, but in relation to a Sunday painter's approach where there is no agenda, just because one loves to paint, you know. And my aim for myself was to create this own little corner to work in to escape the tradition of painting.
Yeah.
And I introduced for myself this sort of wrong element to the mix, you know. I introduced a non-art technique, the threading, the craft of embroidery. in combination with paint. And embroidery is a craft, it's a hobby, and like Sunday painting, it doesn't have a real ideology and agenda.
But you do that also with the subjects and the sort of motifs as well. You, in a way, there's a sort of deliberate perversity in some of your choices. Like, for instance, I think about the wedding cakes. It's like, how do you make serious art from a wedding cake? But you did. You know, you created these wedding cakes which somehow were imbued with all the kind of dread that you might have in an empty interior or whatever. So it's a kind of curious, like you're testing yourself in a way with your subject.
Absolutely,
matter.
Yeah. You come across this image, and of course we've all seen wedding cakes, but then all of a sudden there's that thing, well, hang on, I can make a painting out of that. Or can I? No. Maybe not really. And then you can't let go of that idea, and there are all these connections or all these connotations about the wedding cake, right? This is supposed to be a celebration of the most happiest day of your life or the beginning of a whole new chapter, and then to make the cake look as if it's past its sell-by date, and then again it's about decoration, which is also painting in the end. Painting is decoration,
right? And it was striking to me, like, when you went up really, really close to those wedding cakes, and also to some of the, like, where you would render a tablecloth or a bedspread or whatever, that you were using colours that I immediately associated with Rococo, with kind of decoration and flouncy art, you know? But still, that tension that I'm talking about, that kind of dread, that sense of kind of something dark happening.
Yes.
With also within the space of pinks and yellows and so on, is a really neat trick, it seems to me. Yeah,
you try to walk on a thin edge, I suppose. And sometimes you fall over it, which is good too.
Who was the first artist whose work you loved?
Okay, I'm going to start with being incredibly young, being 4 years old, walking with my mum and dad in the city centre of Amsterdam on the Dam Square, and that's where our national monument is to commemorate the Second World War. I think it's probably the most well-known public sculpture in the Netherlands, but nobody knows who's made it. But my dad was pointing at it and said, this is what your great-grandfather has made.
Ah, okay.
And so that had quite a mesmerizing effect, I suppose, that you can make something like that, of that scale. And so I guess growing up, I was... Sometimes you would meet a teacher who would sort of ask, Radeker, are you family of the sculptor? But yeah, aesthetically, I came to judge it, I guess, in a more honest way, but I think since it was a commissioned work, I think he did an amazing job. When he got the commission, he sort of said, I can't do this by myself. I need to do this with an architect because this is a public square. I don't want a static monument that people need to be in awe of and keep their distance. I want this to be used. And funnily enough, I think when my dad was pointing this out as a 4 or 5 year old, this was like in the late 60s, and the monument was sort of swarmed by hippies at that time,
right,
who were there on a sunny day drinking, smoking, talking, hanging out. And that's what still is happening today. So I think it serves a beautiful function that way.
That's really nice. Did it give you that idea of that being an artist was a thing that was possible? Because I don't think for many people who are that sort of age and grow up in that environment, the idea of being an artist is necessarily a possibility, you know?
No, not really. I think there were always sort of creative people on my father's side in the family, but there was also the stories about how he was sort of piss poor and it was tough to survive. And so I think I pushed that away myself for a long time, the idea of being an artist. I was kind of drawing all the time, and at some point I became fascinated and obsessed about fashion, and I did do my fashion BA. But it took me a long time to admit that to myself, that that was a real thing. You know, when I finished school, I went to study geology.
Yeah.
That didn't last long, a couple of months before I realized I was really fooling myself, and I had to make that step and go to art school.
The easy association to make with fashion is thread, But it seems to me that one of the things that you learn through fashion design is about shape. And you're having to think really hard about shape when you're designing clothes. And about bodies and how they relate to shape. I wonder if that has influenced you as well in terms of forming compositions, in terms of making the forms that ultimately add up to an artwork.
Yeah, that's a good question. Because it is always the question, like, or the acknowledgement, you did fashion. That's now I understand the use of threads. Shape and form. I think fashion is sort of has so many aspects in a way. Mm. It's like how you present yourself, you show confidence, you show you belong to a certain group, you think in a certain kind of way. So yeah, a lot of things come into play, like shape, color, type of fabrics. There's a lot of decisions, the combination of clothes that you wear, that you put on.
And also fashion students work harder than any art student I came across. The fashion students were always up till 2 a.m, whereas the art students were down the pub, you know.
Yeah. I always say, the days in fashion, that was when I worked the hardest in my life. Mm. Yeah. I actually do have another artist because I started as a being very young, 4 or 5 years old. I think I actually did go to museums from a very young age when I was like 10 years old, I think, with some friends. We would go, and of course our attention span was not that long. At some point we started running around and being kicked out, and then we went next door to the Van Gogh Museum or something like that. But I guess as a teenager, when I became much more aware of the world, etc., in the Stedelijk Museum in Amsterdam, there was this piece by Edward Kienholz called The Beanery.
Yeah, great work. Yeah.
And that made a huge impression on me. And it became also for 15, 20 years sort of a tradition that whenever I would go to the museum, I would end it by a visit to The Beanery. Particularly when you're probably very young, it's a very easy work to love because it's like a walk-in kind of type of installation. It has sound, the sound of people talking and chattering and a bit of the sound of music as well in the background. It really is like a cramped sort of bar. At the time, I think 2 people were allowed to be in at the same time. I think now it's only 1.
Right.
Yeah, you were really observing what was going in that bar. And at that age, I had that fascination about America being this sort of perfect, idealistic country far, far away, right, where people were living in beautiful big houses and driving amazing cars, etc. So here I was transported into a bar in L.A., and just all the sculptural elements as well. He kind of poured resin over all the dressed mannequins who all had clocks for heads and were all at 10 past 10.
Yeah.
I think I could only explain it probably because of the eyebrows, maybe.
Right, yeah.
And only the owner of the bar, you see his real face wearing glasses. Yeah, it was just an amazing. And it even had its own smell.
Yeah.
Its own particular smell.
I saw a Kienholz. I'm not sure if it was that one, but I saw a Kienholz as a teenager too. And it blew my mind. The idea that that could be art as well, you know, that art could be something other than a painting on a wall. You know?
Exactly. That was also it, that it, I guess when I was young, going to the museum, it almost had this sort of Disney theme park thing, you know, like that you, instead of some fairy tale, this was the real life, being in a grungy bar.
Yeah, a very bohemian theme park.
Yeah.
Which historical artist do you turn to the most today?
I do not really. I've always been more attracted to the 20th century, mm-hmm. I suppose, and the time when there was photography, films, cars and television, that sort of feels quite familiar to me. But there is this Dutch artist called Hercules Segers. He's not so well known. He was a painter, but I think mostly known for his printmaking. I think there's only maybe like 10, 11 paintings still around of his. And the prints were just astonishing. And most of them are not bigger than a postcard. I only got to know his work because a writer in an essay about my work was sort of making a link, naming him and I had to look him up, and probably about 7, 8 years, there was a big exhibition of his work at the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam, which was just astonishing. So there is this thing that he treats most of the time, the sort of a monochromatic kind of surface. And the landscape is mostly using these sort of otherworldly landscapes. Mostly no people as well.
They're terrifically modern, aren't they? Sort of proto-modern, you know, way back in the 17th century.
Absolutely. And he would sort of allow these mistakes to happen in the prints. I mean, a lot of them deliberately, but there is one, for instance, where sort of tilted on the side, you can see what is going on there. It's like a mast of a sailing ship. What is that doing in the middle of a landscape? It's just weird how sort of this abstract element ended up in the work. And I remember seeing once a Polka painting where he kind of copied that part of the Hercules Sagers.
That's interesting. Yeah. That's really interesting. You've made a couple of works which directly refer to old masters. There was a work by Giorgione and a work by Del Sarto where you actually sort of just directly engaged. What was the thinking behind that? Because, for instance, the Giorgione is that great portrait of a man in the National Gallery of Art in Washington. Why did you want to sort of so directly confront those?
I see that almost a bit as a sort of a youthful sin. And like for the show I'm preparing in The Hague, there won't be any portraits. I think early on when I started to paint, I was just painting and doing my thing. And then slowly, I guess I became aware of the different genres that had been around and I was exploring all of them. And so I try to work with the portraits. But I don't think that they are my strongest works. I only did a few of them.
Mm. But it seems to me that one of the ways that it's interesting to engage in that space is because you're using the materials you are and you're reflecting back from the 21st century about what is a portrait. You know, you're deconstructing the portrait to a degree and you're questioning, as you do with still life and with landscape and so on, you know, what actual role does this have? And it seems to me that's always an interesting space to occupy.
Yeah, I did do this series, which I think were more successful, and I called them tronies.
Yeah.
And they were all portraits of old men. So there was the idea of the man who has lost sort of his importance and role within society, being sort of literally probably impotent. And then referencing indirect, I suppose, Rembrandt, who sometimes didn't maybe have the time to invite a model, and he would just put on a turban and a funny robe and paint himself. But it was not really a portrait as such. It was more the idea of a portrayal of a person, etc. Mm. So I was kind of sort of making these fictitious characters of old men, whereby the folds and all the marks and the skin became kind of the grooves, alive lived, I suppose. Yeah. Yeah,
an artist who I guess we should think of as historical, but he seems so contemporary, is Robert Rauschenberg. And I know he's been an important figure for you, not just in terms of the fact that you use transfers and so on, but also I know that you saw a show at the Met which gave you a means of accessing multi-panel works at a particular moment in your career.
Yes, that's true.
Tell us about that, because you were working in a certain kind of format or within a certain space at that time, but you wanted to expand and you had to find a way to do it, and Rauschenberg kind of showed you the way, right?
Indirectly, absolutely, yes. I guess when I started out, I was fairly careful learning painting and to deal with size. So they were all fairly modest. But then it becomes more of a challenge to go and make larger works. Now, practically for me, that was more difficult because when I do the stitching, I sit on a chair and it's almost like how far my arm can reach. So when I was doing larger paintings, I had to hang them on hooks and then walk around them, which was sort of like endless and tedious. So it was more that exactly when I saw this Rauschenberg show and he was working on these different panels, which I guess many artists had done before, that I had the idea, well, actually, of course, a large painting, I can make a triptych and put them together. And then working in different panels sort of allowed me to include elements like sort of like a Rorschach elements, how things were mirrored from going from one panel to the next. So it became a nice extra painterly effect to play with as well.
Absolutely. And also there were some paintings you made in the 2010s where you kind of fragmented the image. So across the different panels, you'd have different registers, if you like, the space would be incredibly disrupted. And it seemed to me that was really productive too.
Yes, that's very true. Then I started just to do maybe a thing that you're not supposed to do, to cut into your own paintings. And I would then grab different fragments and grab a sewing machine and put them together again. So certain fragments were out and I would work on different canvases and turn them into one.
A Brush With is sponsored by Bloomberg Connects, the arts and culture app. The free app offers access to close to 400 cultural organisations through a single download, with new guides being added regularly. Recent additions to the app include the Instituto Tomi Otake in Pinheiros in Brazil and the South Street Seaport Museum in New York. Among the guides on the app are several museums that have shown and collected the work of Michael Rydecker, among them Tate and the Solomon R. Guggenheim Museum. If you download Bloomberg Connects, you'll find that the guide to the Guggenheim includes in-depth features on exhibitions from its collection. By way of Materials and Motion in the Guggenheim collection has an audio introduction by the curator Naomi Beckwith and texts about works by Xaviera Simmons, Mark Bradford and many others. The feature on key works in the Tannhauser collection has audio content on numerous works in this transformative gift to the Guggenheim, including paintings by Edgar Degas and Pablo Picasso. To explore digital guides to all the partnering institutions, download the app today. It's available from the App Store and Google Play, and you can keep up to date by following Bloomberg Connects on Facebook, X formerly known as Twitter, and Instagram.
Which contemporary artist do you most admire?
I think I go through stages where certain artists become more important than others. I think early on, Tiemens was quite an important one.
Yeah,
I saw his work for the first time at Documenta in 92, and it made a huge impression on me, particularly because it felt that I had sort of certain things in my head. When I went to that Documenta, I'd just been accepted to start at the Rijksacademy in Amsterdam. So it was, for me, quite important because it was the first moment that I would be around other artists. Before that, I was hanging around in the fashion world, and then there was sort of my first steps into the art world. And so I was thinking of how and what my next steps were going to be. And when I saw those Tiemens paintings, they really felt like, yeah, this is exactly what I had in mind. I was doing things at the time when I would stretch a canvas. I would have these sort of nails on the side of the... And he was doing exactly the same thing. So after that, I never did that again. I felt he had claimed that territory. But he had that thing as well, that the painting could have been around for 30 years, right? I mean, that painting of his, the gas chamber, it's so dark, and but the surface looks as if it's got craquelures in it. He made it deliberately wonky as well.
Yeah, he calls it authentic forgery, doesn't he? That sort of curious, again, sort of almost artificially distressed kind of feel that he can establish.
Yeah. Big influence.
But you said that you had to push him out. I thought that was a really interesting thing, that you know, he was such a spark for you. But if you're thinking about an artist too much or to a certain extent, you almost have to kind of, okay, I've got that, I don't need that anymore, and push him out of your mind as you're working.
Yes, you really have to. If someone's sitting too much on your shoulder, right? I think it's that John Cage statement about Guston's work, about having too many people around in your studio.
Yeah.
You have to get them out and... And until hopefully at some point you're even yourself not there any longer.
Yeah,
that's a famous one. I feel good these days because for the last sort of 10, 15 years, I've been really intrigued by certain artists who, in a way, maybe aesthetically, conceptually, are quite removed from my own practice. So someone like Sterling Ruby, of course, who is able to express himself in so many different types of medium. And I'm very happy just to stick with only painting. Don't really or hardly ever do any editions either or works of paper. I was really impressed when I saw around 2013 in the new museum in New York the work by Avery Singer for the first time.
Yeah.
I'd never seen anything like that before, the way to express yourself, the way to portray figures, the technique, the flatness and everything, the reduction in color. They really made a huge impression on me. Someone like Jana Euler, the sort of ugly paintings, and also just skipping around with themes and language. Wade Guyton, you know, made me incredibly jealous that he could just press a button and he had another work. Amazing. And they are so rich in a way when you see them. They almost don't look as if they are made by a machine somehow.
Yeah. It's interesting because, as also true with Avery Singer, there is that element of mechanical process involved. And one of the things about your work is that even though, yes, of course, there is a digital element, even that element is super handmade in your work, isn't it?
Yeah, I find that really convenient that I can just do everything in the studio, that I don't need to have it printed elsewhere. Mm. It's just a technique using laser printer copies with some medium that I glue the works on. It's very, very direct. It almost becomes like a craft, again, sort of like a non-art technique to hopefully make beautiful layered paintings, yes.
Yeah. What do you have pinned to the studio wall? We're sitting in your studio now and you have a wonderful wall of books behind you, but do you have sort of images that you keep around you on the wall?
No, nothing really. I used to. I think from my fashion days, there was also this idea about you were supposed to make a mood board,
yeah,
right? What are the colors of your new collection? What does inspire you? Which sort of artist or et cetera? And you would create these sort of collages on the wall, and this would help then to make the drawings and the sketches, et cetera. So I would continue to do that for many years. Whenever I saw something in a magazine, or I would copy pages out of a book, you know, you buy the odd postcard. But I think today it's all been sort of replaced by using my mobile phone. Whenever yeah. I see something online, I take a screenshot or put it in my sort of favorites album and stuff like that. So sometimes in the morning when I'm having breakfast or drinking a coffee, I flick through them, and sometimes they give me certain ideas, etc. That's how I use them. And yes, I also just grab a book, or if I have an idea about something, I Google the images and get them that way. That sort of really has replaced that.
Which museum or gallery do you visit most frequently?
Again, not really one in particular. I did sort of grow up with the Stedelijk Museum. That was quite formative. I've seen incredible shows there. And
you saw Koons, didn't you, there when you were young? Is that
yeah,
right?
That was quite remarkable in a sense because, well, first there was the show before Koons was Polka.
Right.
And that was amazing. And the thing as well with the Stedelijk Museum is like everyone could come to the opening. So I was there at the opening of Polka, and it was not busy, quite a particular type of crowd. I think mostly German collectors
right.
who, you know, were owners of the work that were on display. But an amazing, astonishing show.
Yeah.
First time I saw a solo exhibition by Polka. I've seen many since.
Right.
And then 6 weeks, 2 months later, there's this Koons opening. And I don't think the Stedelijk Museum has ever seen the museum swamped by that many people. It was absolutely bombed. And I was standing on top of the stairs looking at the spectacle, and all of a sudden I see right next to me Polka standing there with his camera, with a big smile on his face, filming the whole thing.
How amazing.
Yeah, it was so amazing to see that.
Oh, wonderful. Did you reach out to him? Did you say anything to him?
No, I didn't. I didn't dare to.
Never meet your heroes, perhaps. Which cultural experience changed the way you see the world?
It must be related to music. Of course, we get to that one later on, but I think my first hero was Elvis when I was really young. Then it became more sort of the rock thing that was happening at the time in the mid to late 70s. My first concert was Queen. But I think the thing that really made an impression was something that was part of my generation, bands that were sort of almost my age. You know, the media jumped on it and called it the New Romantics.
Oh, yeah.
Or Blitz, which I think Blitz was a much better term to use because it was a club in London that was owned yeah. by Steve Strange of the band Visage. And there were bands like Japan and Spandau Ballet and Duran Duran, although only the early albums of those two, before even my mother started to enjoy their music. But, you know, like Cabaret Voltaire, Depeche Mode, Heaven 17, so many. It was just this generation that was really coming from the UK where I think life was miserable. There was a big economic crisis. But by dressing yourself up, going clubbing, forgetting about everything and making music using these sort of new instruments, electronic instruments, synthesizers, drum computers. Mm. And it was the whole package, right? It was not just the music, it was also the record sleeve. What do you dress? What does the stage look like? It became this whole world. And to be part of that somehow, it was the beginning, I suppose. I mean, clubbing had been around for maybe since the disco days or even longer, but it became this thing that you would do to escape reality and to belong with like-minded people.
One of the things about that generation is that so many of them were art school kids, and
you know, exactly.
But also they were unashamed to acknowledge art. I'm going to make a confession here. I too was a big Duran Duran and Japan fan when I was young, and it was people like David Sylvian from Japan and Nick Rhodes from Duran Duran talking about Andy Warhol and Jean Cocteau and all sorts of others that led me into art, really. They would unashamedly engage with things that other people were calling pretentious and tell people about them. And I think that was crucial to a generation of people, a generation of art students, actually.
Yeah, somehow they seem to be the first of things to come later on. Exactly how I mentioned this idea about club culture that was sort of then exploding and later on, plus the whole electronic music industry.
Exactly. You've obviously got a very creative approach to titles, and I see lots of those early 80s bands mentioned. There's one called Propaganda, and I presume that might be a reference to the band called Propaganda. There's To Cut a Long Story Short, Spandau Ballet song, The Reflex, Duran Duran song, and so on. So you pull from music quite a lot in your titles, don't you?
I did that mostly during my early days. Maybe at some point I ran out of song titles or references to use, but I've always found it important to title my paintings. It's sometimes quite disappointing when you're in a museum, you walk up to and then it says untitled. I'd like to point people in a certain direction. And even when I was still living and working in the Netherlands, I chose English titles. It's a language which is not my own still after all these years. So it's a word, it's not a name. That's why they're always in lowercase as well. Sometimes it's a couple of words or a phrase, but yeah, I like to point the viewer in a certain direction.
There has to be an element of ambiguity there, right? So you can't hit it too much on the nose, as it were. It has to permit the viewer a sort of poetic space, if you like.
I agree. I think it's sometimes, you know, you see a painting of a church tower in front of some trees, and then it says, church tower in front of trees. So yes, I think it's nicer to, or more interesting to play with that.
Which writers or poets do you return to?
I think there's never enough time to return to anything. There's too much going on. And I think during the years, my reading patterns have changed as well. I think I sort of ended a 6 to 8 year period where I couldn't read any novels. I found it impossible. I would start and tried and put them down quite quickly. And I could only explain it that, you know, it's all coming from, you know, fantasies from someone else's mind. And I'm dealing with fantasies all day long. So I went through this phase where, yeah, I just wanted to read about hard facts, nonfiction, biographies, etc. I did start to read a little bit more fiction again, but I don't really have any real heroes, or, you know, there are some people who have the patience and the time to reread certain books yearly.
Yeah.
I think I've only done it once or twice.
Yeah.
Probably a Bret Easton Ellis and a Kundera.
Right.
But overall, no, I find it really difficult.
You're creating your own poetic space, which is interesting. There's an interesting thing that you said when you first went to art college and so on. It was in the kind of wake of that obsession in the 1980s with French philosophy and so on. It seems to me that's quite an interesting arena to enter into when you're studying at art school, when it opens up a bit, because it was very narrowly obsessed art education in the 1980s with that kind of postmodern philosophy and so on. And were you kind of encouraged into reading a particular kind of nonfiction when you were at art college?
I think art college for me means sort of my fashion days.
Yeah.
And then when I did the Rijksacademy and later on Goldsmiths, you were being considered an adult. You've had your education and now we're just specializing in the things that you already found. But yes, when I sort of came through the back door and was all of a sudden a painter after my fashion days, there was that thing that I was observing and tried to understand what had been going on, what was going on. And that's when I realized there was a lot of hoo-ha about all the French philosophers, and I found that quite difficult to grasp or to relate to, I suppose. this sort of, it seemed quite sort of strict dogmas that you had to follow.
Yeah.
Almost.
We've already talked about some music, but what music or other audio do you listen to while you're working?
I love listening to music when I'm working. I guess 80-90% of the time when I'm in the studio, there's some music happening. And I never listen to the radio. I always feel I have my own radio station and I can decide whatever I'm going to listen to. That means that I love to start with a lot of instrumental type music in the early hours. I sort of carry my own music history with me, but I love also still, you know, discovering and exploring new music or music that I didn't know about from the past. So I've been listening to a lot of ambient music from the early 80s made by Japanese artists I'd never heard of, or Italian artists, sort of more contemporary artists I've been listening to over the last sort of 5-10 years, or probably like Klein and Dean Blunt, Yves Tumor. One of my heroes is Ricardo Villalobos for the last 20 years, who is a sort of a house DJ.
Yeah, sort of minimal techno producer and so on. Yeah.
The amazing thing with music, it's sort of a mood enhancer. You play a certain track and then all of a sudden you're humming along or singing along, or your body starts moving without you even noticing it. Mm. And to experience music in a live setting is quite something as well. I mean, an album is like half an hour long. When you go to a concert, it's an hour or 2 hours. But going to a club and be taken on a journey by a DJ for 4 or 5 or more hours is quite astonishing. And it's also something that can only happen in that setting, which is, you know, there's this whole world going on and nobody's really writing about it. We live in such mediatized times, but there's still a lot going on that nobody really writes about. You have to experience it, to live it, to know what it's about.
You've described that your process has stages. Does different music accompany different stages?
Well, I like the fact that in a way, because my paintings take a long time to make, that they have absorbed all these different types of moods and music types that I've been listening to.
You've got an amazing speaker setup. We're in the studio and there's speakers right at the top of the room. So I can imagine, is it quite loud? Can you really boom it out at times?
I can. I rarely do that, but yes, I definitely can.
That's great. What other media influence your work?
I think anything can take you on a journey in a way and can inspire you. It's impossible to tell where inspiration really comes from or what triggers what. I guess the more obvious ones are watching a movie, seeing images as a visual artist. But there's not one particular thing that I would say. It's all there. It's all out there. There's so much out there.
To what extent was David Lynch an influence? Because there's a quote, and I think it was in your Howes and Worth show some years ago, there was a quote from David Lynch that accompanied the show, and it was, "How big the mind is, we do not know. The mind is a beautiful place, but it can also be pitch dark." It's a really eloquent way of describing your work in some ways. Did you look at David Lynch? Do you see things like Blue Velvet and think, that's where I want to be? You know, kind of.
Yeah. I mean, I think around Blue Velvet, and there was also this whole Twin Peaks time. You know, you would see the episode, and then the next day in school, you would discuss it and try to figure out what the hell was going on. And Mulholland Drive, I think, maybe for me is my most favorite Lynch film.
Yeah. It's that suburban space that you were talking about that he said.
Yeah, true.
The violence of suburbia. Yeah.
The violence, the loneliness, I suppose. Yeah.
There's also this film called The Swimmer from 1968. You've made some amazing paintings of swimming pools, but never have swimming pools looked such threatening spaces, except in this film called The Swimmer, which is a really strange film.
Oh, it's a beautiful movie.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful movie. It's such an odd one for Burt Lancaster, right, to be the main character, to be so lost. Yeah, so he goes on a journey in the valley where he sort of lives, and he decides to make his way swimming from pool to pool. And then with every pool there, he meets his old friends. And it's quite unclear what his situation really is. And of course, later on, you slowly find out that he's completely lost. We do not know if his family is still around. He comes to his own home and it's all boarded up, and it gets darker and darker, basically. It starts as, you know, the sunny swimming pool setting, and it becomes more and more dark and ominous.
It does indeed. Is there a particular discipline in your daily working life that you see as an essential ritual?
I guess walking in the door, it's like I get into my uniform, I put on my painting clothes, so that I guess is the first step. You maybe subconsciously you flick a switch, put on some music, and then maybe the making teas and coffees are sort of moments to interrupt your day, or maybe buying more time before you feel you're going to do something that you're dreading to do or nervous doing.
Yeah, I like that idea that you said earlier on about sort of flicking through the images on your phone, and the idea that one might lodge itself somehow in your mind and that can be carried through into the work somehow.
Yeah, it's great that when you have a lot of ideas in your drawer, I always like that at some point you think, okay, what am I going to do next? And you open your drawer, you rummage around and you think, that one. That's kind of a luxury situation, because sometimes you realize it's pretty empty in the drawer. It's nicer when an idea can ripen or you have ideas and at some point you think, actually that was not the best one. Let's wait with that one or throw that one in a bin.
If you could live with just one work of art, what would it be?
Oh, maybe a bit of a cheesy one is to say to live with my wife's work, Ranva Kunoy, also a painter, amazing painter. Mm. We've been living together for 20 years. So I'm living with one of her works. And what is remarkable with her work is the type of pigments that she uses. I always love going to people's houses and look at the art they have there. And how they live with the work. And it's so different than the situation in a studio or in an art gallery in a museum, right? I mean, where there's like 80 fluorescents hanging above you. Yeah. You've got this whole white glow. You don't do that at home. And I think with her work, it's remarkable how the work seems to change whatever type of weather it is, whether it's in the morning or in the evening. It's remarkable. So that's my cheesy answer.
Not cheesy very, at all.
But very true. And then when I have to think of something that we may all know, which I also found difficult, because most of the things we know from going to the museums that we visit, it's an odd one to feel that you're stealing that and keeping it to yourself. But okay, it's a game. It would be good to choose something from when I was already around, and so I was thinking, wow, it would be amazing to be able to live with a de Kooning, like clam diggers or a woman, Sag Harbor, sort of like from probably from like 63, the year I was born. Or I was thinking of maybe an early 90s black and white computer graphic Albert Olin painting, one of those large ones, or to stay large, one of Sterling Ruby spray paintings, even more recent. That made me think of this sort of incredible service that exists in the Netherlands for many, many years, where you kind of have a subscription. You pay like a monthly fee and it allows you to have a work for a year or two in your own home. It's kind of a way to sort of lower the art level, that people can just have a work. If you really like this work, you can buy it. If not, you swap it for something else at some point. I was kind of thinking, wouldn't it be amazing to do the same thing as what I just mentioned? You know, you have an Öland for 6 months, or you ask for a Doik. No, sorry, the Doik is not available, but you can, for 10,000 extra, you
a
can
library
have
for artworks. I mean, it's like what Jim Eade did at Kettle's Yard in Cambridge. You know, you go and you take a Ben Nicholson home with you, or a Miro or whatever. You know.
Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised if this service exists somewhere in the world. Yeah.
Lastly, what's art for?
Art is for communicating, but different than any other form of communication, I suppose, right? It's different than reading a book or watching a movie, having a conversation. It's a unique experience that starts for me as a visual artist with the visual experience. I like the fact that when you look at a work of art, that there is this very brief moment, don't know how long it lasts, when you see something and you're just looking. You're just looking at something. And then the rationale sort of kicks in, right? You put it in a category. You start thinking about the whole reference library that you carry with you. But that just that first moment of looking and seeing, that's a wonderful form of communication. That's really unique in art.
Michael, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Michael Raedecker, Material Worlds, is at the Kunstmuseum Den Haag in The Hague in the Netherlands from the 13th of April until the 28th of August. And Michael then has a show at Grimm in Amsterdam from the 30th of May to the 20th of July. And that's it for this episode. Please subscribe to A Brush With wherever you're listening, and do give us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts. Do also subscribe to our sister podcast, The Week in Art, a deep dive into the latest big art world stories, the top shows and the key issues every week. And please subscribe to The Art Newspaper at theartnewspaper.com. We're on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Tan Audio, and on Facebook, Instagram and Threads. Production, editing and sound design on A Brush With are by David Clack, and the producer is Lewis Jebb. Thanks also to Daniela Hathaway. A big thank you to Michael Raedecker. See you next week. Bye for now. A Brush With is sponsored by Bloomberg Connects. Download Bloomberg Connects today and discover cultural institutions on demand.